It's November 2021. World leaders gather in Glasgow for COP26, the United Nations Conference on Climate Change. The British naturalist Sir David Attenborough takes to the stage. Many expect him to give a stop warning, but instead, it's a bold vision.
A new industrial revolution, powered by millions of sustainable innovations, is essential. We will all share in the benefits. We must use this opportunity to create a more equal world. And our motivation should not be fear, but hope.
Outside the conference centre, protesters show the frustration at the slow pace of change. It's hardly surprising, really. In recent years, the effect of climate change has made itself felt around the world with increasing frequency.
Around Australia, coastal erosion is eating away at a life of surf and sand.
Crop shortages linked to climate change are leading to extreme poverty and hunger.
At least 550 people have died after a cyclone hit southeastern Africa last week.
And it's not just the developing world that's been hit by rising sea levels and freak weather events.
By the end of this century, as many as 13 million Americans will be forced to move because of rising sea levels, flooding, and erosion.
Politicians have been here before. In 2015, President Barack Obama warned of the dire consequences of climate change.
And the best scientists in the world are all telling us that our activities are changing the climate. And if we don't act forcefully, we'll continue to see rising oceans, longer, hotter heat waves, dangerous droughts and floods.
Sherry Goodman is a senior strategist at the Center for Climate and Security in Washington.
Climate change amps up or aggravates other existing threats. So vulnerable populations across particularly Africa, the Middle East, parts of Asia that were already water and food insecure become even more so.
At an individual level, public behaviour started to respond to the threat of climate change.
This idea of constantly being able to produce more things and that the fact that the resources are endless is something that is an impossibility.
When you start thinking about how damaging it is to the environment, you just do not want to get out of bed.
And societies around the world have been forced into action by a new generation.
For more than 30 years, the science has been crystal clear. How dare you continue to look away and come here saying that you're doing enough when the politics and solutions needed are still nowhere in sight?
So this is the CACEIS Climate Briefing. I'm Pat Sharma, Managing Director for CACEIS in the UK. Our aim in the series of podcasts is to address the reality of climate change and how we move forward. We'll look at how things are going to have to change for the pensions industry, whether we're trustees or asset managers. And we'll be asking what our collective responsibilities are. After all, we're all in a powerful position to influence the behaviour of businesses for decades to come, but we have to get it right. Joining me today is Professor Lorraine Whitmarsh, Director for Climate Change and Social Transformation at the University of Bath, and Chandra Gopinathan is a Senior Investment Manager with Railpen. So let's dive straight in and really get to the heart of how we as individuals need to consider the risks of climate change and impact on our behaviours. So Lorraine, tell us how you think people need to change their behaviours, really for us to meet some of those targets that we've set.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is actually a huge amount that individuals can do. So while it might sort of seem when we're watching the COP announcements that this is all about kind of governments and high-level negotiations and it may sort of feel quite distant, actually, the evidence suggests that most of the things that we need to get to our net zero climate change targets will involve at least some degree of behaviour change. So we're talking about things like reducing driving and flying, changing our diets to eat less red meat and dairy, using energy in different ways, particularly using renewable energy, wasting less. And then there are things that we can do in the workplace and in communities and in our conversations in day-to-day life as well to try and influence other people. So I think there's actually a lot that individuals can do to help tackle climate change.
How do you think we actually encourage people to change their behaviour? Because do you think people really link their behaviour and their personal impact to climate change?
I think to some extent, I think people are really starting to think about climate change when they make decisions, but it still tends to be quite low down the list of factors that people are considering and reasons why they may or may not change their behaviour. More often than not, the reason why people might give up their car, for example, or cut down on meat is for health reasons, for cost reasons, for convenience reasons, for a whole range of other reasons that aren't necessarily to do with climate change. So it may be sort of something that in the back of their mind they think, oh, and I'm also sort of going green. It tends not to be a primary motivator for most people. And so people are concerned about climate change, but in their day-to-day choices, it tends not to be something which is a sort of major factor that drives their choices.
So Chandra, how do we make it a major factor?
It's an extremely interesting question, an extremely under-researched topic, in my opinion. Behavioural changes are, I mean, if we think about how humans have, or us as individuals have changed our behaviour to using the iPhones, getting acclimated with new designs, etc., it's a lot to do with the science behind it actually marketed in a much more user-friendly sort of way. So I think the solution there is really climate education, and climate education in a way that's not pedantic, not preachy, but also sort of linking the science to actually the day-to-day and vice versa. So going back to linking food, for example, to what the emissions profile of the food industry is overall. And education at various different levels in a simplified manner, I think could be one way. But there's a lot to be researched on the subject still. I think that could be one way, just getting people to understand this better in a much more lighter and a fun way. I wouldn't say fun. Fun's probably too light a word, but in a much more, much less pedantic fashion. So it's not, IPCC said what it said, COP26 has done what it's done, but it just needs to filter down to the bare bones, and it needs to be done in a much more user-friendly sort of way.
Yeah, and I agree, but how do we do that? Because, you know, I was talking to someone in the office before I came here, and he was saying, I have meat every night. I don't want to change eating meat every night. I enjoy having meat every night. But I was actually reading something that actually states that, you know, meat production has increased by 5 times since the 1960s. I mean, I don't think people appreciate that, you know, we're eating so much more meat now. I agree the education's there, but how are we going to really encourage people to change and to see that actually eating meat every night is not normal?
See, I go back to two simple examples. One is, you know, we've had the zero sugar argument where, you know, we've gone in and marketed drinks which are less in calorie content, less in sugar, displayed the content on shelves and on packaging. And that's helped. The other thing you're starting to see is a lot of travel websites starting to publish carbon emissions and showing that as part of an... I think a lot more of that is needed. And those are just initial baby steps. I'm not saying it's going to be easy, but I think those are the sorts of things that can continue more.
Lorraine, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think education and information definitely has a role to play. I think we need to inform people about what are good choices, because actually, for example, with diet, not everybody does know that the type of food that you eat actually does have quite a big impact on your carbon footprint. So it's one of the most effective things you can do is to cut down on red meat consumption. But so we can educate people. That's definitely true. And we can put labels on things to encourage people to make those choices in the supermarket as well. But actually, information by itself tends not to be very effective to change behavior, usually because there are barriers to behavior change, so that even if you know what's the right thing to do, it can be expensive or inconvenient or sort of just seem weird or kind of unusual. So what we need to do is to have economic measures in place that make high carbon products more expensive, low carbon products cheaper. We need to have regulations so that the most polluting products are actually phased out. We need to have change on the supplier side as well, so that products are made in less carbon intensive ways. And you gave the example of the sugar, of sugar in food. Actually, the sugar levy has been really effective at getting suppliers to change the recipes of food so that actually there's less sugar in things. And so the consumer doesn't necessarily even need to see some of those changes. They can happen on the supply side, but the impact is people are eating and drinking kind of in slightly healthier ways. So there can be things that are behind the scenes, and then there can be things that consumers are maybe more aware of, that like the change in prices or regulations, et cetera, or availability of things that get people to just try things out, and they're cheaper and they're more convenient and so on.
And do you think that change in government policy is going to drive change? I've read some articles and things about maybe enforcing the restriction on the number of flights you can take a year. Do you think we need to be that tough?
Personally, yes. I mean, I think what we've seen so far is that it's been left up to individuals to voluntarily change their behaviour. And there's been a reluctance on the part of governments to push too hard in terms of getting people to change their lifestyle. But the evidence is pretty clear that those sorts of voluntary behaviour changes by themselves are not going to be enough. We can't just leave it up to the tiny minority of people who have chosen to give up flying. We need to actually discourage people from making multiple flights a year. We need to encourage people to change their diet, to drive less and all these other things. And we need to do that in a way that is fair so that it isn't just the keen few that are making sacrifices, that actually everybody is changing their behaviour together. And it's going to be much more effective if we do it that way. So, yes, we need to pretty quickly move up to governments regulating and putting in place much stricter measures. And in the meantime, you know, encouraging people to try and make it easier for people and more attractive and cheaper and all these other things as well. But regulation will have to follow, I think, some of these softer measures.
What about fashion? So Chandra, you know, fashion, I've seen numbers around, it's responsible for 10% of emissions and a ridiculous amount of water is required to make one pair of jeans. I think it's 3,781 litres of water for one pair of jeans. But with cheap fashion, you know, you can buy a pair of jeans for £10. What do we do there?
Again, a complicated sector, I would say, particularly fashion retail, and mainly because the supply chain is so widely spread out globally. So for companies to be able to identify and their various different their supply chains, which contribute. I mean, if you have a manufacturing plant in, let's say, Bangladesh, and you have a factory workers, there is the employment angle as well. There is the social angle as well, which sort of goes in along with. But there is so that companies, especially large companies, need to take the initiative. And regulation does help on that front. There will be a policy if there are policies in place that require, and along with consumer education, I think that is pretty much going to be the combined solution. People changing their behaviours, being forced to change their behaviours and being educated alongside at the same time. That's going to be the journey.
What we're so used to, you know, being able to buy so many clothes. How do we change that when I can buy a pair of jeans for £10?
I think about it the same way as you know, going to the supermarket and looking at the 99p donuts over there. It's bad for you. It's right there in front of the shelf for a reason. The bag of Doritos is on discount almost all the time, and it's at the time when you get out. And that's the same thing with the fashion industry and with cheaper jeans as well. You see, you're going to see that pile over there, which is 50% off, and that's probably going to be exactly consuming the amount of water that you mentioned. Then it becomes about regulation and individual choice, and how do you train yourself to think about this in a more responsible sort of way? So it's a combination of what governments will do and what individual choices will be.
And maybe if I can just add, and I think what we also need is policy that actually encourages businesses to make things that last longer as well, because at the moment the incentives are not there for businesses to make durable goods. They're really more there for businesses to make things that just don't last and that will need to be replaced, you know, within months or maybe years. And so we need to encourage producers to actually make things that last longer, like, and actually have a responsibility to maintain those things and in terms of also what happens at the end of those products' lives. And there's starting to be this extended producer responsibility regulation coming in, but we need much more of that sort of thing to shift the incentives away from disposable items to more durable things.
A really interesting debate is how much carbon is generated by the different sort of sectors of the economy. But a recent article reported by The Economist stated that listed companies actually only generate between 14 and 30% of carbon emissions, quite wide spread there, but still relatively small. And the biggest producers are actually state-owned companies such as Coal India. So should there be an introduction of a carbon tax across all public and private companies to incentivise them to move towards driving lower carbon emissions? Is that one way to do it, do you think, Lorraine?
I definitely think economic measures like a carbon tax have a very big role to play. The evidence suggests that, again, by themselves, they're not necessarily enough, because there may be sort of ways in which, you know, people can kind of get around the economic measure, and kind of there might be sort of perverse implications in some cases. But broadly speaking, yes, what we do need is the price of products to reflect the environmental impact that they have. And what we know from our research as well is that the public broadly likes the idea that polluting products cost more and less polluting products cost less. It sort of appeals the idea of the polluter pays, you know, that you actually, yeah, if you're going to get something that's really going to put loads of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you should be paying more for that because it is making life worse for everybody else. So that is something that is, broadly speaking, quite attractive to the public. And we know as part of a set of measures, it can work as well.
And do you think, Chandra, do you think that will help with asset owners such as pension funds in respect if there's a carbon price put into, you know, a company? Do you think that that's going to help pension funds make a decision about which companies they might invest in for the future?
Absolutely. I mean, having a carbon price in place is definitely, I mean, based on what your emissions are, and you, if you pollute more, then you pay more. And that affects your margins. And with pension funds, that process, that modeling process, the analysis process is already underway. So we are looking at emitters and as per, you know, net zero commitments and whatnot that we've gone out with to start looking at key emissions emitters within our portfolios and applying carbon price scenarios already. Now, fact of the matter is the real world economy and governments are lagging, and it's quite a disappointment that through COP26 we didn't see a carbon tax come through, even with the developed nations where, you know, the affordability is still there for carbon tax. So that's a worry, that whether that goes on, whether the political will is there, whether the business lobbies are actually for this versus not. And that's going to be the challenge going forward, particularly with state-owned companies, whether it's, you know, here or in emerging markets. So, but from a pension fund standpoint, we're factoring that in. We're assuming that it will come in, if not now, in the next couple of years, and you know, manage our portfolios accordingly.
So in business terms, as we move from a high carbon economy to a low carbon economy, are we in for a bumpy ride? Lorraine?
The way in which the sort of low carbon transition is discussed is that what we need to have is something that's planned and fair, and so that there aren't huge sectors that are kind of dismantled that are very high carbon that mean that people are going to be losing their jobs, and that this is about kind of huge sectors of the, you know, of people basically being kind of left behind. What we need to do is to ensure that those people are given the skills and kind of transition into greener types of job. And so, you know, people working in livestock agriculture, for example, or in the fossil fuel industry, we need to think about what's going to happen to them and move those and skill those people. So the transition needs to happen in a sort of planned and fair way. And unlike, you know, obviously with COVID, for example, we had a very sort of overnight shutting down of everything. And it, you know, it was important to do that. But what we can do here is do it in a more planned way. So I hope it will be not as, you know, disruptive as we've had with COVID.
Chandra, your thoughts?
I'd say timely and predictable policies are pretty much the way to go, because will it be a bumpy ride? If policies are, they happen in a matter of weeks or months without much notice, and they happen in a very abrupt sort of way, then it will be a bumpy transition. We're starting to see a little bit of those sort of bouts of volatility already. If you look at oil and gas prices, and if you look at a few of those things where, you know, things are, they feel uncomfortable at the moment. So timely and predictable policies from the government. If that happens, then the ride becomes easier. And ensuring a fair transition or a just transition, which is part of what most net zero frameworks require, is make sure the transition is done in a socially fair way, in a just way for the employees who are losing jobs because of fossil fuel shutdowns, coal plant shutdowns, all of these sorts of things. Maintain affordability as well. I mean, there is the argument for going green at any cost, but can people afford it? Think about those things as well while the transition happens. So, yeah, it's all a question of how thought out and how predictable the government is in these policies and regulators are in their policies, and how well canvassed these are as well to the people. So they know this is coming. People are expecting a carbon tax. Phasing something in a gentle but sort of affordable sort of way would be a great way to go, in my opinion. And hopefully that happens soon.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we've seen really is that in some ways the public is ahead of governments in terms of really pushing for climate action. They're there on the streets, they're calling for change, but they want government to enable them to make those behaviour changes. So they want it to be kind of easier and more affordable and available for people. And so I think it's really about kind of bringing people with us, but they're already kind of wanting that change. So I think governments now just need to implement that policy.
In our next podcast, we're going to really look at pension funds and some of the new regulation and talk about net zero. But actually, when I look at pension funds, I look at them as individuals, and we've been talking about individual behaviour here, which is fascinating. But pension funds are made up of individuals as well. One, we've got the members, you know, and those members as individuals, they're going to start to have their own view and they're going to want to change things. So they're actually going to look at the pension funds from a different perspective. But then I think we've got the trustees as well. As individuals, they're going to have their own behaviours to think about in respect to how they manage climate change. So I've spoken to some trustees who just don't believe in climate change. It's not a problem. It's all about tree hugging. Well, actually, no, it's about the risks and the risks you have within the pension scheme. So what is your view?
To me, there's climate change and the beliefs around climate change and the actions around climate change centered around two things. They centered around the individual and around the collective. You can be an individual who's responsible for a pension fund, be a trustee, you can be a politician, you can be a government official who's responsible for a whole bunch of people and decisions and policies, and you could still litter and not recycle. And that's a problem, because to me it's about both. So you need to take your responsibility as an individual and do what you need to do as an individual to be able to combat climate change. You need to have your responsibility towards the collective, which is, in my opinion, a much bigger force for change when you're trying to lobby and bring in carbon taxes, bring in new policies, and have that belief entrenched in both sides of your responsibilities, both as an individual and as a collective. So, and that's the only way. And that they both contribute and go a long way. The systemic obviously goes a lot longer because you're representing the interests of many more individuals than just yourself, and you're working on their behalf as well. And that makes it a lot more powerful overall.
So come on, Chandra, what do you do as an individual then?
I recycle like everybody else, which is, and I'm trying to improve. I am getting better with my dietary habits. I mean, I have reduced consumption of red meat, and the food industry is huge in terms of pollutions. And I think being more aware, being more conscious, being just cognizant of the impact that you and your choices, me and my choices, have on the environment itself is a great start. And I think we all can do our bit.
I agree. I mean, I've got a bunch of friends who probably think I've been quite a bore over the last few years. Whenever we have a party, I've got a bag for the plastic, a bag for the cardboard, a bag for the paper and whatever. And they think I'm a bit crazy. But I actually think the two are linked in what we do, our beliefs and how we act as individuals also will come into our workplace, maybe as a trustee or an asset manager.
Being one doesn't take your responsibility away from the other, for sure. As a trustee, and especially when you're responsible as a trustee or as a member of the government or responsible for several different people's opinions and have the power to influence, I think you need to be doing more. There's no question around it. So the fact that you do it at home isn't good enough. You need to do more.
So thank you so much, Lorraine Whitmarsh and Chandra Gopinathan. Really, really interesting insights from both of you. Thank you. So in the next episode of the CACEIS Climate Briefing, we will look at more of the granular detail of what we can do and discuss exactly how the collective influence of the pensions industry can help protect the planet.
The key question, the key focus, and the thing that's really challenging to get the data for is that financed emissions. So your total exposure through your investments is clearly the big question, the big number. And for companies, it's the same sort of thing. So that full value chain, end to end, do you really have a handle on what the emissions are throughout the whole value chain, and are you putting in plans to reduce along the full value chain?
You've been listening to the CACEIS Climate Briefing. I'm Pat Sharman. Goodbye.